is.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, January 26, 2022. This meeting will consist of three parts. Board of Education from 2 until 2:15. Board Education from 2:15 to 3:15. We will take a 15-minute recess and reconvene at 3:30 for our business section. This session is being officially audio recorded and times shown on the agenda are estimate only. This virtual meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 2028, so there is no live public comment period. However, our community members are welcome to comment on any item or concern via a letter addressed to the commissioners at 834 Sheridan Street, Port Townsend, 98368, or via email to commissioners at jeffersonhealthcare.org. All commissioners are present. And at this time, I'm asking Commissioner Call to share the land acknowledgement.
Thank you. As you may recall, Jefferson Healthcare adopted a land acknowledgement last year, and it reads as follows. We acknowledge that Jefferson Healthcare is on the ancestral and contemporary homelands of the Sklallam, Chemekum, Twana, and other indigenous nations, and we recognize the tribal government's sovereignty across the region.
Thank you, Commissioner Kolf. And I now call for a move to approve today's agenda.
So moved.
Okay. Case? Second. Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? All in favor, please raise your hand. Okay, thank you. That's unanimous. We will go in now to our governance discussion. The 2022-23 final strategic plan. Our CEO, Mike Glenn, is presenting the final plan. So, Mike?
Well, I'm just here. I gave the final presentation, I think, at a previous meeting, and we decided that it needed to be adopted. So the purpose of this, which is why we only have like 15 minutes carved out, is to allow for any questions or comments or perhaps a quick run through. But basically, it's the same document that it's been presented the last two times. And since it's January, I would be asking for a board motion to approve. But if we do want to kind of fly over it one more time, that would be fine, too.
Let's just hit the high points and then just to get it on the record.
All right. So next slide. Seen this before? It's our big dot goal. still believe COVID's going to be a thing in 2022. Hopefully, it won't define our work in 2022, but it will be part of our work. And in addition to that, delivering high quality care. Be a great place to work, which has always been important and never been any more important than right now. Provide services that our community needs most, whether it be traditional, conventional hospital or medical center-based services, or standing up testing centers, standing up vaccination centers, or in the case in the next week or so, helping to distribute antigen test kits that, because of our rural health clinic status, we are expecting to receive. Improving the patient experience and remaining financially independent. Those are the six big goals. Next slide. I will make a point about delivering highest quality care. What, you know, that there are so many subplots to the last 21 months. And one of the subplots that we are beginning to see emerge is the cost of COVID distraction. Brandy and I have looked at several nationwide reports that are identifying an increase in patient safety events and other quality related issues. Presumably or possibly because of organizations' intense focus on COVID. So you're going to hear me use the term double down a lot. We are going to double down on our work to eliminate avoidable errors from our system. Next slide. You heard me talk about this. Nothing is more important, and we are. I'm happy to say that we are taking steps to come out of this this challenging period better and stronger. That's the good news. The challenging news is that we've got a lot of work in front of us, but we're committed to doing the work. Next slide. Next. The big item here is the hospital 65 building old hospital replacement project and campus modernization plan. Jake's given a couple of presentations on how the that process is advancing, and we're getting close to a point where the work will begin. We'll reach to governance stakeholders, community stakeholders, and validate what we think we know about specialty service needs in our community and growth and expansion needs in our community, and also ask some open-ended questions about what needs are perceived. But that work will begin in earnest soon, as well as Jake and Tyler and a whole bunch of others figuring out different financial models to pay for it. And then population health to improve community wellness. We are elevating that role at the hospital and anticipate that work growing in importance and as well. That in addition to Jefferson Healthcare beginning this to look past the COVID fog, so is CMS, so is CMMI, so is the healthcare authority. So we are beginning to see the green shoots of growth of different value-based, risk-based, ACO-like programs these payers are reaching out to us and asking for our input in developing, which is much better than reaching out with us a product that take it or leave it. Next slide. And next, improve the patient experience. I think it's been on every strategic plan since 2011. It always starts off so intuitive. And then when we peel back layers and really do the work, challenging to do really, really well across the entire system. And that comes from a healthcare consumer of in several different systems, as well as the hospital CEO, where I think we need to stay motivated to truly make healthcare as as sensible and friction-free as many other service products are now. And next slide. And then remain financially independent. Very tightly connected to remain operationally and governing independence is financial independence. And I know you all understand that. When things work out okay and our business model is working, it's just a matter of constantly minding the operation. The last couple of years, we couldn't have anticipated, some of this, the steep reductions in revenue, but thankfully federal and state programs helped us. But I anticipate this becoming more and more of a challenge in the next 2 to 3 years, when I think some of those same federal and state programs that helped us out during difficult times will be reminding us of that, and maybe trying to squeeze some of that back from us. So we will remain very focused on this because I have zero interest, and I'm quite certain the five members of the board have less than zero interest in a governance model that isn't wholly held at in Port or in Jefferson County.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Is that does anyone have any comments other than you're right spot on about that last remark? So does anyone have any comments, questions? Okay, then may I have a motion then to accept the final 2022-23 strategic plan?
So move.
Second.
All right, moved and seconded. Any discussion?
Good job.
Yes, it's an audacious plan and an excellent job, certainly. All in favor, raise your hand, please.
Aye.
Okay, that looks unanimous to me. Accepted. Great. Thank you, Mike. Great job.
Now we'll go to work on a 3-year plan. And this year, there'll be no weasel terms this year, Mari.
I noticed that. Well done.
We must. I think it was appropriate appropriate 2 years ago, convenient and appropriate this last year to kick this down the road, but you can't keep not planning anything more than 12 months out. So that's a commitment from us. We will deliver a 3-year plan at the end of the year.
We'll look forward to that.
Okay.
Thanks. All right, we'll go into our education.
I'm sure you'll strive to do that.
And this is an annual report regarding our oncology program, and it will be presented by Corey Quigley, our Nursing Supervisor of Oncology and Infusion Services, and Tina Toner, our Chief Nursing Officer. Okay. Somebody take it first, Tina or...
Hi there. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys this afternoon. My name is Corey Quigley, and I'm the nurse manager of our oncology clinic and infusion center. And it's a privilege to be here with you, commissioners. Thank you for your service, and I really appreciate your time today. I invite you to ask questions at any point during the presentation this afternoon, and there will certainly be time at the end as well. I look forward to any questions you have about what we're able to offer to our patients here. Alyssa, next slide, please. Thank you. So I'd like to share a little bit first with you all about the patient experience here at our oncology clinic. And what we really like to do, what we strive to, is to exceed patient expectations, really aligning with one of Jefferson Healthcare's values. So I wanted to share from their own mouths, in their own words, some gratitude and appreciation from our patient perspective. first story I have to share with you today, these are actual images from cards our patients have given to us, which is a beautiful thing. When we walked through the dark door, that is cancer, we didn't know what to expect. What we found were caring nurses, fun-loving receptionists, and thoughtful doctors. Thank you for being a wonderful part of our lives. You will all be missed. This was a letter that we received from a current patient of ours undergoing treatment for pancreatic cancer, whose journey will be ending on his own terms as he's decided to pursue death with dignity. Not everybody's cancer story ends with a survival, but we know that there are many ways for people's cancer stories to end successfully. And sometimes success means helping a patient have control in a time when they have no control in their life and being able to have a death on their own terms and a death with dignity. This letter really moved me because it really speaks to what we can be for our patients while they have time here with us and the impact that we make not just on their lives, but in all of the lives of the people who love them as well. Another patient shared that after her partner had passed, "It's with a heavy heart that I'm sharing with you how my husband fought bravely to the end. Although we would have liked to be back in Port Townsend, it was comforting to have our children and grandchildren by his side, holding his hand to bid him farewell. Please share with your staff my grateful appreciation to them. They did everything to support him through the treatment at JHC. We could not have found a better group of wonderful and caring people. Thank you so much, too, for your help and kindness through this difficult journey." I'll have you go to the next slide, please, Lisa. All right. Oh, Alyssa, can I get you? Oh, thank you. Another letter to share here. "Thank you for your care during these past 2 years of my treatment. Although I have yet to see your smiles, I felt them during each appointment. You are an extraordinary team of people, and we all benefit from your kindness and expertise." This is a real point of pride for me, managing a team of really caring people through such a challenging season as this very long pandemic has been. Many of our patients started their treatment with us during the pandemic, and so we've been providing care to them every day, despite our own mask wearing and their mask wearing. And I just really loved being able to have an appreciation for the fact that we can still make a connection. We can still have people feel our smiles and know that what we really do for them here is care for them through times that they would never choose to be a part of otherwise. This is the sort of thing that really feeds us to be here through the ups and downs for our oncology patients. And then lastly, I wanted to highlight a patient who doesn't come to us for oncology treatment, but we are an infusion center as well. And so we treat patients from all walks of life with all varieties of illness. Some may be MS patients or rheumatoid arthritis patients, patients with Crohn's disease, and we make an impact in our community for more than just cancer patients. This patient shares that, "I'm writing to let you know how impressed I've been with the professionalism and terrific care I've been receiving at your infusion center. I've been many times now, every 6 months for my meds, and every time the nurses have been so incredibly caring and good at their jobs. I used to go to Harborview and was not happy when Regents stopped that. My doctor at Swedish set me up with a local SQUIM neurologist, and now I come here. Boy, am I happy about this change. These days, I consider going for my infusion like a visit on a cruise ship or something. Great view of the water, lunch is served, veggie marinara today, yummy, unending Lorna Doone cookies and flavored water, and a mini break from my house. Today is no exception. Julia got the med set in my vein super fast with no pain. The procedure started on time with no glitches. Jasmine brought my lunch, but with no dessert. When I said that she should tell the cafeteria to add desserts to the meal, and I said I love hospital chocolate pudding, Jasmine found one for me. Double yummy. Also, the unit here seems like a very cohesive group with happy employees working together to make the patient's experience as pleasant as possible. Kudos to the charge nurse who sets the tone for everyone. If SQUIM starts an infusion center, I will beg my husband to do the drive to Jefferson because you all here are that good." Again, this just goes to show that it does make a difference, the environment that we provide for our patients. We've worked really hard to create a healing space, a space that can bring some calm in an otherwise tumultuous season in people's lives. We focus on comfort. We focus on an environment that allows for peace and healing as much as we can. And it's a real point of pride for us when patients share that that's been their experience here as well. Melissa, I'm going to have us move on to the next slide, please. So some of this information may be repetitive for a few of you. However, I'd like to provide a brief history of our oncology and infusion center here. In 2012, Jefferson Healthcare opened the oncology and infusion clinic. Dr. Ann Murphy joined the oncology clinic, bringing with her a host of patients from her own practice. 2014, we developed a multidisciplinary cancer committee and on-site cancer registry was established. In 2015, Dr. Kurt Neumann joined our team. In 2016, we moved into this beautiful building and we were able to develop a clinical trials program as well as a survivorship program. 2017, we pursued accreditation. And we were granted Commission on Cancer accreditation as a community cancer program. And we did that while achieving the highest level of commendations possible. It was something that our team worked really hard for, and it's a real measure of our professionalism and our commitment to the highest level of cancer care that is possible. In 2018, we developed a triage role, which helped support patients' symptom management throughout the day and also developed after-hours coverage. In 2018, Mary Towns, nurse practitioner, joined our oncology team. And then in 2019, Dr. Deborah Abrams joined our team, and we established the Jefferson Healthcare Specialty Pharmacy out in Port Ludlow. This pharmacy helps our patients gain access to their specialty medications, chemotherapy meds that can otherwise be very challenging to fill. 2019 brought the development of our social work and psychosocial services programming. Tess Taft is an oncology social worker who focuses on counseling services, and Jessica Piper is a social worker. They both joined our team that year. And in 2020, our Commission on Cancer was up for renewal for accreditation, and we were able to reaccredit without any deficiencies. And then in 2021, we recognized the impact that our psychosocial services were having on our patients, the ability to meet their needs beyond just the clinical aspects of cancer care. And we were able to hire Jessica Piper into a new role of psychosocial services program manager. And we're really excited about what this opportunity brings to our patients. And I'll be sharing with you a little bit later in my presentation some of the work that's really gone on in that department and how our patients have benefited.
Could I ask a brief question?
Absolutely, please.
Yeah, could you describe the survivorship program a bit?
Absolutely. Our survivorship program is a fledgling program still. Because of the advancements in cancer treatment, there is now an entire population of people being treated for a disease that may have been terminal and is now managed to establish them as chronic patients, if you will. So a survivorship program has many roles, one of which is if a patient's cancer has been treated and they reach the end of treatment with no further disease, it's a roadmap for them to follow, for their primary care providers to follow, so that they understand what medications they've received, how much of those medications they've received, how often do they need to be following up with their oncologists, how often do they need to be following up for specialized tests that perhaps their primary care doctors will order. Another big aspect of the survivorship program is it allows patients to feel a connection to the group of people who were their lifeline throughout their treatment. Patients can grow very attached to their oncologist, to their nursing team, to their support staff team, social workers here, it really allows them a connection still with us and a plan on, now that they're healthy again, how do they move forward in their life? How do they begin to think about going back to work? How do they begin to think about recommitting to some of the intimate relationships in their life, things that they had to completely put on hold? So we have a social worker, Jessica Piper, and traditionally we would have an APP or an advanced practice provider in that role as well, where we offer survivorship clinic appointments one day a week on Tuesdays. Right now, we're in the process of recruiting a new advanced practice provider, and both of the candidates that we're looking at have a really promising relationship with survivorship and are very motivated to continue and grow those services here.
Is there any group effort to get those patients to come together in some way other than with the staff at Jefferson Healthcare?
Absolutely. In fact, you'll see that's one of the growth opportunities that occurred in 2021 was we established a survivorship support group. So it has now joined the ranks of our other three support groups as an offering for our patients to come together and support each other through their own survivorship. Right now, due to the pandemic, all of our support groups are still online, but we have a lot of participation in them, and I know that they're still incredibly meaningful and impactful to our patients.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for your question. All right, Alyssa, thank you. I'm sure you're all very familiar with our provider team. I just shared with you when they all joined the practice. However, if we go to the next slide, I wanted to share some information with you, also from our patients, about their perspective in working with our providers. These are direct quotes from patients from their PICR survey. These are surveys that are sent to patients after a visit with a provider, so we can really capture both the best experiences they've had, but also learn from any challenges that they may have experienced while they were with us to make sure that we're doing our best for them every time that they're here. So Dr. Murphy is amazing. Dr. Murphy is the best. 3 exclamation points. So grateful for her kind, brilliant, compassionate care. Dr. Murphy has been my doc since having my cancer about 5 years ago. I love seeing her every year. She has been so nice to me. Awesome in all respects. I've recommended Dr. Norman to friends. Dr. Norman is one of the best doctors I know. Very patient and compassionate. Dr. Norman is an exceptional physician in every regard. I was very impressed with the gentleness of Dr. Abrams. I wish all doctors were like her. Deborah Abrams has gone above and beyond to help me understand the preventative care needed and create an ongoing care plan with me that meets my needs. Dr. Abrams is very easy to talk to and understand. I will share, because we're all human, not every provider and patient find that they're the best fit for each other. And what's so exciting about our oncology clinic is that we have a complete team approach. So when a patient identifies that they may have a better fit with a different doctor, that is something that happens, and our providers share patients readily to ensure that there's no gap in their care, that communication can be clear and consistent, and goals can continue to be met. So we also really provide ourselves on taking feedback, no matter what it is, from our patients, and really trying to meet them where they are. Our goal is to support them through their cancer diagnosis, and that means listening to what their needs are. And that's really something that we're excited to be able to do. Next slide, please, Alyssa. All right, so a little bit of a share here. I do have one valuable nurse on our team who prefers not to have her name or face shared publicly. However, she did give me permission to share her initials and a photo with a few minor edits, hence the smiley face there, which does really speak to who JG is on our staff. So one of the points I really wanted to do in introducing you and showing you to our staff is that 9 out of our 13 nurses are oncology certified nurses. The remaining 4 nurses on our team all comply with the required 36 hours of continuing education requirements in oncology annually. It's a real point of pride for a team as small as ours to have such a high percentage of nurses who have pursued oncology nursing certification. It is certification validates that our nurses have met stringent requirements for knowledge and experience, and they're qualified to provide competent oncology care. These nurses participate in education and certification programs that are rigorous, and they meet nationally recognized standards that are reliable and legally defensible measurements of oncology nursing knowledge. The standard for the COC is to have some of your staff be certified in oncology nursing, and the number of our staff who are motivated and excited and have opted to pursue their certification is just a huge point of pride for me. And we've recently edited our badges to show those credentials to our patients, and already we get questions from patients about what that means. And it's such a beautiful opportunity for us to be able to really talk the talk about the walk that we're walking, which is that we want our knowledge to be at its utmost at any given moment. And it really allows an opportunity for us to educate our patients about what it is that we do to keep them safe, to be able to answer their questions, and to truly work as a team in providing them their care. So these are just a few of our nurses with their OCN certification. Next slide, please, Alyssa. So Jefferson likes to recognize employees who are difference makers. And I'm really excited to share that we've had quite a few difference makers on our team of late. So here is our team celebrating JG's award as a difference maker, and some words from her nominator. JG is a stellar patient advocate. She goes beyond providing care for patients while they are in our clinic by thinking about what would best serve their needs once they've left the clinic too. A patient was recently referred to our clinic for IV antibiotics. Upon assessment, this patient had extremely poor venous access. JG collaborated with an ED provider for ultrasound-guided peripheral IV placement. When that line failed, she collaborated with pharmacy to change method of administration to IM, or intramuscular. JG is one of those caregivers who walks the walk and talks the talk. She understands that it takes a village to provide best patient care and actively collaborates with her JH village to ensure best patient outcomes. Next slide, please, Alyssa. So I also wanted to take a moment just to share with you about some of the impacts that COVID has had on our team and how our team has risen to the occasion, just like everyone at Jefferson has. It's really been a truly incredible place to be during the pandemic. So our response to COVID, even prior to Governor Inslee's mandate, I was exceptionally privileged to just see that our staff put their own health and their patients' health first by 100% participation in vaccination. Every time a new drug has become available through an emergency use authorization for the treatment of COVID, we have our lead oncology nurse, Ayla Skipper, who's worked with our provider team to develop a policy and then provide education to the staff throughout the hospital who may be administering medications to those COVID-positive patients. In addition to that, our infusion team provided staffing to the RegenCove clinic for COVID-positive patients that we did for several months here at Jefferson. And it was another way for us to use the skills that we have as oncology certified nurses in truly understanding the risks of giving medications that have potential for incredible negative reactions for patients, not just in terms of side effects, but in that moment while we're giving the infusion. These are medications that have been authorized for emergent use. They haven't been studied as long as meds traditionally be studied before we give them. And it's really comforting to know that you can have a nurse who has the experience almost daily with reactions like that, who can be educating you about how to give this care to patients and provide you with the calm that you need in those moments that a reaction may happen. So I'm really proud of our team for the work that they did in supporting our community and continues to do while we manage this pandemic. Next slide, please, Alyssa. Thank you. So in the past, when we've provided our annual cancer report to you, we did that because it was a standard that was expected for our COC accreditation. And so the points that I'm sharing about our clinic today may look a little different than the data we shared before, which was very data-driven about numbers of diagnoses. We no longer have to present that data in a public fashion, which really gives me time to share more of the heart of our clinic and what it is that we do here. I'm not sure how much opportunity any of you have had to spend in our clinic, and I hope that it hasn't had to be very much at all in the grand scheme of things. But there are a number of things that we do that really help find our patients some comfort and peace while they're here. On the left here, you'll see a beautiful quilt. We get comfort quilts donated by cabin fever quilters on a regular basis. And this allows us to provide a homemade quilt to every oncology patient starting treatment. It's their first day. They're usually quite anxious about being here. They're being overwhelmed with information about their diagnosis and their treatment. And it's just a small thing that we can do. They get to pick out a quilt in the colors of their likeness, and many of them choose to bring this quilt with them to each treatment. It's just a small thing that really makes a big impact. Another small thing that we do is we mark the end of any treatment cycles by providing a bottle of sparkling cider that we've signed. Our infusion staff, our oncology staff, our pharmacy staff, pharmacy decorates the bottle, and then we're able to pass it on to patients, and it's just a moment of delight. There aren't a lot of moments necessarily in this journey that anybody would choose. So being able to create a moment that has a positive impact is such a satisfier for us in what we do here with our patients. And I can tell that it really makes an impact on them as well. Lastly, I wanted to share, you'll see in this image not only a quilt that was made and donated by a patient, but next to it is a bell. I'm not sure if you guys have had the opportunity to learn much about ringing the bell, but I wanted to share that it's thought that the tradition began at MD Anderson in 1996. A rear admiral in the Navy was being treated there, and he told his provider at the time that he intended to bring a bell in and ring it upon completion of treatment, as it was an old Navy tradition to signify a job well done. So he brought in a brass bell to the last treatment, and he rang it several times, and then left it at MD Anderson as a donation. They mounted it on the wall and put a little plaque by it with a poem that the patient wrote called Ringing Out. Ring this bell three times well. It's told to clearly say, my treatment's done, this course is run, and I am on my way. So it's a really meaningful point in most patients' lives to be able to ring the bell here. And what started off as a tradition when people were done with treatment has really shifted as our care for cancer patients has shifted to one of more chronic illness management. We have patients set their own goals about what might make them want to ring the bell. Some patients may ring the bell more than once because their treatment involves radiation and then chemotherapy, or chemotherapy and surgery. Some patients end up needing to come back for more treatment in the management of their illness. And so we really let them define what is a measure of success, what is something that they would like to celebrate in their journey. Next slide, please, Alyssa. I wanted to take a moment and introduce you to our two social workers. This is our oncology psychosocial services team. Jessica Piper is our psychosocial services coordinator, and Tess Taft is a licensed counselor and social worker who provides free counseling services to our oncology patients and their family members. Next slide, please, Alyssa. So we had some really great development in 2021 regarding our psychosocial services program. And this is in no small feat because of Jessica Piper and who she is as a human being. She is so motivated by gaps in care. She is so motivated to see where there are needs for improvement and to just get out there and find solutions. So one of the things that she recognized was that there was a real need for our patients to have some e-health literacy, meaning they needed a better understanding of how to be on MyChart, how to access their providers virtually. And so she procured grant funding from our foundation to purchase iPads for in-clinic use, and patients could schedule appointments with her to sign up for MyChart, to learn how to use the service. It was a really successful program that's made it easier for our patients to communicate with us what their needs are. We also offered a new survivorship support group in that year. That is in addition to our breast cancer support group. We offer a bereavement support group as well as the caregiver support group. It's really important to recognize that while we treat cancer patients here, the model of treating cancer is to really treat the whole family as the patient defines that. So we want to make sure that our services are available not just to our patients, but to the people who are help supporting their patients. So not only are they getting best care here, but their caregivers have the support that they need to provide best care at home as well. And then we're really proud that our two-person social work team provided nearly 1,000 patient visits in 2021. And those are visits here in clinic. It does not include any of the phone calls, care coordination, their support groups, or family support services that they're able to offer. So we're very grateful to have them be a part of our team here. Next slide, please, Alyssa. Also in 2021, Jessica Piper was chosen to attend a highly selective integrative oncology program that's being offered with the National Institute for Health and the University of Michigan Medical School. Jefferson Healthcare is the first time that anyone has ever been chosen to participate in this program from a critical access hospital. So this program is helping her learn more about integrative oncology programs that support traditional Western medicine. One of the things that has allowed is a collaboration with Mary Elin. She is one of our infusion room nurses who is really interested in alternative methods for treating nausea and vomiting. So they did a plan, do, study, act cycle and were able to secure grant funding again from the foundation to allow us to trial offering aromatherapy for alternative management for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. So patients are now offered, when they come into the clinic, one of two scents of these little clips that they can use. They last for up to 3 weeks. They are hands-free, drip-free. We ask patients to fill out a survey for us upon completion of using them so we can best learn if they're actually helping patients, how they're helping patients. Another way that this program is helping to improve our patient experience, Jessica has developed a study on the impacts of treatment on female oncology patients' sexual health and developing supportive interventions to make sure that that topic is something that's addressed. She will be presenting these findings to the JHC Cancer Conference, to multidisciplinary oncology teams from the NIH, as well as cancer centers nationwide. So she's making connections with organizations countrywide who all aim to do what we do here, provide the best care that we can for patients going through something nobody would ever choose to be going through. And we are really excited for the ways that this program can continue to grow. We have a large population of patients in the Port Townsend area who are really interested in complementary medicine and recognizing that there's a space for lots of support in the realm of cancer treatment. Next slide, please, Alyssa. So as we look forward to our psychosocial program development for this year, I'm excited to share that we've recently hired our third oncology social worker to expand our access to patient and family support services. So Narissa Whitlock will be joining our team in February. We are interested in looking into how we can expand programs into art and music therapy being offered here at Jefferson. I will say expanding the program because we do have patients now who will bring an instrument with them when they're here for treatment, and you can hear the strains of a fiddle through our hallways or an auto harp. It brings a patient comfort. It keeps their hands and heart busy while they're here getting treatment, and it really fills us up too. So I'm excited to see what we're able to do in that realm. We're going to be seeking extramural funding from the NIH and American Cancer Society for the Integrative Oncology Program Growth and Development, as well as training opportunities for our staff. We will be focusing on health equity in oncology care and addressing barriers to care as we do every year. It's a COC standard, but it really is an opportunity for us to see how can we be doing better. And a gap in care that we've identified that we'd like to focus on for this year is transportation. So we'll be doing some outreach to underserved populations here in the Jefferson community to provide access to cancer screenings, as well as working with community partners to help address transportation needs for our oncology patients. And then lastly, we'd like to continue to offer and expand what sort of support we can give to caregivers through evidence-based interventions. And that's a large part of what Jess's program in the Integrative Oncology Program focuses on as well. So we look forward to what ideas she can bring back to us.
Could I ask another question, Colette?
Yes, please.
You mentioned earlier about a patient who was choosing death with dignity, and this psychosocial program slide reminded me that I have a question about what role Jefferson Healthcare plays in supporting death with dignity.
Absolutely. So it is a standard that let me see how I can say this. There are legal requirements for a death with dignity. A patient has to inquire about it on their own, and they have a visit with a first provider who educates them about the process and determines their eligibility. Eligibility meaning a diagnosis that is terminal. And then there's a 14-day period prior to the patient meeting with a second provider for the same assessment, to ensure that the patient has plenty of time to understand the ramifications of what they're asking for, to make sure that they have plenty of time to process for themselves with their family. And then they'll visit a second provider, and our physicians are able to prescribe. It's a cocktail of medications that can be prescribed to the patient. And then the patient is responsible for picking up those medications themselves and administering those medications themselves in whatever space and time they feel is appropriate. So for our end of things, we provide support to patients by allowing them to meet with two of our providers and then prescribing them the medications. They're also welcome to meet with any of our psychosocial counselors. So Jess and Tess play a role in that. And then I will say too, our ethics committee plays a part in it. Because if there's ever a time or question when a provider feels uncertain that this is the right path or needs to collaborate with another provider about what the right thing to do is, there is that established pathway as well.
Great. Thank you. A very important service, and one that is so important for us to preserve through our policy, practice, and financial independence. Thank you.
I couldn't agree more. I have worked at organizations that have been purchased through organizations that do not support those services, and it truly is a detriment to the patient when they do not get to have that control over their life in a state that has decided that is their right. So thanks. Next slide, please, Alyssa.
Craig, I just wanted to tag on to Case's comment and actually compliment you on how you started the presentation, where you spoke about a patient's experience who wanted to learn and chose death with dignity as part of their treatment regimen. And what I am pleased about is the way that the caregivers in this organization have normalized that. In some communities, it's far from normal, but I think the way our teams approach it offer objective, matter-of-fact information in a non-judgmental, supportive way, and then are there to assist, whether it be with providing the pharmaceuticals, or more in some cases, is just a lovely option that we can offer to our patients. And I think it really caps off the comprehensive nature of our program. So I'm very, very pleased about that too.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate all of your support, because I truly feel like to be a cancer center is to be a comprehensive cancer center and to let patients remain as autonomous as they can through their journey. A next slide, please, Alyssa. So you guys have heard a lot about Jessica today, our psychosocial services program manager, and she was also recently recognized for being a difference maker, which I'm sure is no surprise after hearing a lot about what she's brought to our program. Jessica has been working in conjunction with the hospice team since November of 2020 to provide supportive care and services for a particular patient. He initially presented with a complex social situation, lack of support systems, and many different challenges related to his end-of-life needs. With all of Jessica's care and coordination, we will finally be able to make our patient feel safe, comfortable, and supported during the last leg of his life journey. Jessica has worked diligently to assist this patient with housing, caregiving, resource coordination, emotional support, building a trusting relationship, and the overall management of his care. I am so impressed by Jessica's advocacy for our patient. Healthcare advocates like her make me so proud to work for Jefferson Healthcare. She is walking the walk each day. Sometimes the desire to help all those in need with limited resources and in a rural community can seem overwhelming. When we can help even one person at a time to the extent that she has helped our patient, it confirms our commitment to providing award-winning care at home. Next slide, please. So I'd mentioned earlier how proud we are to be accredited as a community cancer program. That journey started for us in July of 2017, where we were awarded our initial three-year cancer committee, cancer accreditation with four commendations in July. In 2020, we went through a reaccreditation process, and we were renewed. It was the very first remote site visit survey that the organization had did. And we were proud to be reaccredited, and we will be up for that to be renewed again in 2024. Next slide, please. So I just wanted to share some of the highlights from our 2021 Cancer Committee program, our medical director, Dr. Ann Murphy, is our Cancer Committee chair. Next slide. One of the standards that we meet every year is a quality initiative and community outreach project. In 2021, we elected to focus on improving our cervical cancer screening rates. So the first step in that was to complete a PDSA, or a Plan Do Study Act, for this quality improvement, which helped identify the problem that cancer screening rates overall were dropping during the pandemic, as most were choosing to stay home, which resulted, of course, in a reduction of life-saving screenings. 2021 was the first time we sort of saw some light in the tunnel that has been the pandemic, where we felt that there was an opportunity for us to encourage patients to return to healthcare facilities to try to ensure that we don't end up with late diagnoses, as that is going to have a negative impact on disease outcomes. So we determined that some interventions we could employ immediately were to use social media, patient outreach, and population identification. Who do we need to get this message to, and how do we get it to them quickly? And how do we get it to them broadly? So social media was a helper there. We decided to start the project in June, and then we tracked monthly to see if we were having an effect on increasing the number of screenings during this time. Pre-pandemic, our baseline rate of screenings for cervical cancer was 85 per month, and we were looking to increase that number by 10% on a monthly basis. So again, our project started in June, and we assessed it through November, where the team worked to provide outreach to those due for IPAP or HPV screening. These are females ages 21 through 64. And then we set a goal for ourselves of having 105 screenings per month. And for each month that we focused on this endeavor, our total number of screenings were continually meeting or exceeding that goal of 105 per month. So what that really did for us was get patients screened sooner so that any cervical cancer diagnoses could be made earlier and hopefully create better outcomes for those patients through treatment, but also just reiterated the best way that we can get our message out to people. And it's an endeavor that we will continue because we can see how simple it is and also how effective it is. Next slide, please. So a large part about being an accredited organization means that we are bringing as many brains to the table as we can for our patients' care. One of the ways that we do this is we offer a multidisciplinary cancer conference twice a month. It occurs on a virtual basis presently. One of the benefits we learned, though, from being able to offer this service online is that a number of our primary care providers were able to participate more than they had been before because they could attend their clinics. And then our cancer conference is hosted between 12 and 1:30. So during their lunch break, they can come on and learn a bit more about their patient's diagnoses and the plan for their care from the providers who are actually making those plans. So when I talk about multidisciplinary attendance, we have a radiation oncologist, a pathologist, a radiologist, our surgeons attend, primary care providers, dermatology team, our social work team, our triage nurse, our research nurses, physical therapists, dieticians, pharmacists attend as well as our oncologist. And it's really a time for us to come together and discuss possibilities, recommendations, where the more information we have, the better. And in 2021 alone, in quarter one, 44 cases were presented. Quarter two, we saw 51 patients discussed. Quarter three, 58 patients were discussed, and the care of 38 patients were discussed in quarter four. And I'd like to just shout out Brittany Huntingford, who does an amazing job of being our cancer conference coordinator. So we could not do that work without her. And next slide, please. I wanted to just let you know who we touched, who we impacted, who did we see in 2021. So during that time, that 1 year, we saw 260 new oncology clinic consults. Not all of those are cancer diagnoses. Our providers also specialize in hematology, but it's 260 people right here in Jefferson County who got to have their healthcare needs met by a provider at home. 5,045 oncology clinic provider visits. These are patients who are established with our providers and who are receiving treatment. And so they're coming in on a weekly, every other week, maybe every 3 week interval for their treatment. We had 82 radiation oncology consults. We have an oncologist who is contracted with us and she's here once a week. And it's just another opportunity for patients to not have to drive to a neighboring county to have those needs met. And then we nearly saw 10,000 patients in our infusion center last year. And my final slide, Alyssa, is just taking a look at what's to come in 2022. We really are working to focus on workflow standardization and efficiency. We have three very different providers who, for the most, one is full-time, our other two are part-time. And so they provide their care in the best way that they know how, which means it's individualized. So we're looking to find ways that we can standardize the workflow to make it easier for our supportive staff to support their clinics and ensure that each of our patients who comes through our door gets the same level of care just as efficiently as possible. We're also looking to expand our space. We have very rapidly outgrown the space that we have here, and we just need more exam rooms to meet the need of our patients. So that's a top goal of ours this year as well. And then lastly, we're in the beginning stages of a feasibility study to assess whether or not offering radiation oncology services on our JH campus would be possible. And I'm thrilled to be a part of that project at its baseline and see how it is that we could potentially make our patients' lives even easier. So I really appreciate the time that I had with you all here today. Please don't hesitate to ask if you have any other questions.
Questions from anybody? Well, Corey, that was an extremely uplifting report. It brought tears to my eyes, and it's impossible to overstate how important and comforting it is to a patient to have the compassionate and personal care that your team provides as you walk down that scary, dark journey of a cancer diagnosis and treatment. So thank you to all of us who work with us, who have been or are on that journey. Your team really is the light at the end of the tunnel.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to not just me, but to all of us. And I'll ensure that they feel that recognition as well, because they're the ones out there every day doing the work who really deserve to know that their impact is being felt. So I appreciate you sharing that perspective.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, Mari?
I'd say that's one of the most comprehensive and extremely well delivered, unbelievably fabulous, if you can say that in that context, report I think I've ever experienced on the board. So thank you. And thank you to the staff. And as an infusion once a month allergy serum recipient, I can attest to what a great department, a great positive attitude the staff, whether it's front staff or the ancillary staff or the people who take care of me up there. Fabulous, just unbelievable, you guys. And considering that's relatively new clinic in the grand scheme of my life at Jefferson, and it came from very humble beginnings. So unbelievable. Thank you, staff. Thank you.
I will be sure to. Thank you so much for your kind words. It's greatly appreciated.
I also want to compliment Corey on the terrific job she's doing upstairs on the unit, as well as a fantastic presentation, and also on how reserved she was when she just sort of casually mentioned her interest in exploring introducing radiation oncology to the campus. That a very, very important decision that Jefferson Healthcare is going to have to make, and my bias is going to be pretty obvious here when I talk with you about the two options I'm most interested in. One option is whether we introduce a linear accelerator on the campus, and maybe where down the diagnostic imaging hallway, where for those of you who have been around for a while, the pad where we used to bring the MRI, that could be a place where we dug a hole, planted a vault, and were able to provide radiation and linear accelerator radiation oncology treatment, which would be amazing for this community, even though the distance from medical oncology. The other model we're going to look at, since you only build a building every 5, 10, 20 years, what if what would a comprehensive cancer center look like in a section of the new building where we could couple medical oncology, radiation oncology, which is clearly clinic best practice. That I know that's a model that the providers and caretakers are very interested in, just because of that proximity. What would that look like? How could the medical oncology space be repurposed for the other specialty care uses that we would be building out in the new building anyway? We're certain that there would be an added cost to that model, but I'm also certain 10 years down the road, it's hard to believe anybody would be critical about us doing it. We are exploring how to do this. We're pretty committed to it. It's such an important next step for our cancer program. Corey and Tina and Jake and now Tyler have been on this, and Josh Brocklesby has been on this review for about a year and a half now. And we're going to be really excited to really put it on the fast track and decide what's best for our community in the next 5 or 6 months.
Great.
Okay. Is there any other comment or question? Okay, then in that case, we will.
Yes. I did just, sorry, I don't know if you saw my hand. I did just want to. Okay. I did just want to reiterate, as Mike said, our big thanks to Corey. And it's been just a year this month that Janelle retired. And as we all know, those were some pretty big shoes to fill. And Corey has went from a nurse on our oncology clinic to a supervisor to a manager of our oncology clinic. And she has just done amazing work. We're so proud of her. And she is a big part of that secret sauce of that amazing department that we all are so proud of. So just big thanks to you, Corey.
Thank you so much, you guys. That means so much. You're right. This is a department that has been grown from the ground up with a lot of passion and a lot of heart. And to be a part of it is a joy. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay. If there's no other comment, then we will end on that happy note. And we will break now until 3:30. So we'll see you then. Thank you, everyone. Brittany's doing this right now?
Yes, ma'am, we are ready.
Thank you. Thank you both. You're a great team. All right. Welcome back to the business portion of the January 26, 2022 Jefferson County Public Hospital District No. 2 Board of Commissioners meeting. We began with a patient story from Tina Toner, our chief nursing officer, who has a really tough act to follow with Corey's presentation.
I do indeed. And I'm even spotlighting the 2021 difference makers. And Corey started us off. So that was wonderful. She did a fantastic job. I'm really proud of her. Before I get started, actually, though, I did want to just turn it over to Commissioner Koff. He had a patient story he wanted to share briefly.
Thank you, Tina. At the Board of Health meeting last week, one of the Board of Health members, Dennis Stearns, mentioned that someone close to him had been told he needed to have a COVID test before he could be seen by his primary care doctor for an earache. And he wondered if this was standard practice. Dr. Barry and I assured him that it was not, and I asked Dennis to send a letter about the incident that I could forward to one of our patient advocates. I'd like to read a little part of the letter that he wrote. My friend reports remembering clearly about being told about the test requirement and that he could go to the urgent care instead without needing to do the test first. He ended up going to urgent care because his ear pain worsened and reports receiving excellent care, albeit after a long wait. It could be, I suppose, that the person he spoke with wrongly assumed his reported symptoms were COVID-related. In any case, I just wanted to follow up with you and let you know, as you both mentioned, I am sure 99% of this had to do with the holidays and already strained staffing levels. Thanks to you both for all you do for public health and for the public. We remain fans of Jefferson Healthcare. All the best, Dennis. Well, I forwarded his letter to Jackie, who responded immediately, and it appears there was likely some miscommunication. And she asked, let's see. Oh, and here's part of the letter that she wrote to Dennis and to me. Thanks so much for sharing the experience when calling to schedule an appointment. First, I want to reassure you that we use patient experiences and concerns as opportunities to improve care. No one will, quote, get in trouble, end quote. I'm glad he had a good experience in the Express Clinic and sorry for the delay in being seen. I reviewed your question with a practice manager of one of our primary care clinics. She said that if his medical concern was only the earache, then she apologizes for the miscommunication. However, if, when he called, he answered yes to questions regarding additional symptoms, such as headache, sinus pressure, nasal congestion or drainage, scratchy throat or sore throat or cough, then he was given the correct information. We're asking patients to be seen in the Express Clinic or get a COVID test prior to being seen in a primary care clinic if they have these COVID-like symptoms. Thank you for your support of Jefferson Healthcare and bringing this concern to our attention. We know it's not easy to report care concerns and appreciate that you took the time to do so. Sincerely, Jackie. By the way, what I'm reading is what they wrote, but I did leave out certain parts of what both of them had written in order to preserve the privacy of the patient involved. Finally, here is Dennis's last response. Hello, Jackie. Thank you so much for your thoughtful and helpful response. I'm exceedingly happy to hear that there is such a positive approach to patient input that focuses on the opportunity to improve. I was involved with board leadership for 10 years related to Virginia Mason in Seattle when they implemented lean principles such as continuous process improvement to achieve patient-centered care. Thus, I am a big believer in this approach. As I mentioned, my friend is very much a, quote, go along to get along, end quote, type of person, and he probably was not assertive in trying to explain that his symptoms were not COVID-related. All that said, these are trying times, and I know Jefferson Healthcare is doing its best under very difficult circumstances. So again, nothing said here should be taken as a complaint. Thank you again for your assistance. Wishing you all the best. I thought this was a very nice story. It did come out, as I mentioned, at the Board of Health meeting yesterday. And I think it does highlight some of the important procedures that we follow and how they can sometimes be misconstrued or misunderstood, but that ultimately through the service that our patient advocates provide, we can have very positive outcomes, relationships with our community, and learn to improve as we go along. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to read those letters.
Thank you. All right. So our 2021 difference makers, I think you might remember that the last few years we have given out the Rockstar Award, and our team is so phenomenal. They are rock stars. And as we continue to get nominations in, we were recognizing just how far above and beyond our team was going and what a difference they were making. And so in 2021, we shifted from our Rockstar Award to our Difference Maker Award. And I just wanted to share our 2021 Difference Maker recipients, as I think they're always the story behind the patient's story. So we're going to start with our January and February nominees or winners or recipients. So we have Kara Ely and Maria Van Ness. They, as lead RNs in our ACU and ICU, they made significant contributions to those departments, often juggling many tasks and all the while providing excellent patient care. So that was January and February. Moving on, we have Gina McKinnon, who was a nurse in the family birth unit. She was recognized for leading the way with cross-training efforts. She trained in multiple departments and is now formally in a new role as a resource RN, and she supports the ACU, the ICU, family birth, and ED. And then Jessica Piper, as Corey already shared, our psychosocial services manager. She's a true healthcare advocate supporting patients with all of their needs. And then our next for May, we have Starla Crowell. She is an RN that works in multiple departments, the ACU, the ED, and surgery. And she was recognized for her professionalism, her attitude, and her flexibility in supporting all of those departments. She will just go wherever she is needed and has been a key player as we've been working through this year. Robin Bridge, an RN in our ED department and a nurse here for many years, he was recognized specifically as a mentor to staff and students and the excellent care he provides to patients. And then in July, we had Amy Tichgalar. I can actually say her last name. She is one of our house supervisors. And as you know, the role of house supervisor is very dynamic, and she is very innovative in her approach in managing the house and jumping right in and working through those busy days. So big shout out to her. We recognized Marianne Muck in August, who works in our dietary department, and she was recognized for being just a real connector in that department for all of our employees that stop or that go through dietary and our community, and just her warm personality. And then in September, we have Laura Gamarez, a CNA in our acute care unit. She was nominated for being exemplary in many different areas, but her flexibility really stood out. She was just willing to shift gears mid-shift to support patient needs and will just do all she can to support our patients. Michelle Carson is a health navigator in our case management program, and she is instrumental in supporting the discharge needs of our patients and goes the extra mile to help as we're making sure that they are going to be safe at home. And then we had our November and December. November was the amazing patient advocate that wanted to remain anonymous in this public meeting. And then in December, we have Christy Davis, who is an RN who recently in our acute care unit who recently stepped up to a charge nurse role and has embraced that opportunity and has a very much a positive can-do attitude. So these were our 2021 difference makers. They truly make a difference for our patients. They can be that difference between, you know, feeling being alone or being cared for, between sadness and encouragement, and for their teammates, they are the difference between a good day and a fantastic day. So big thank you to all of them.
That's wonderful. Yep. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Tina. That's another uplifting report, and congratulations to all of those nominees and their teams that work with them. Thank you. And to you, Tina, because you encourage people to do their best. So thank you. So we'll move on now to the minutes of December 15th, 2021, and January 5th, 2022, special sessions. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, please raise your hand. Okay, unanimous. Thank you. And now we move to required approvals. Is there anything anybody wishes to take out of that? Okay, may I have a motion to approve the required approvals?
So move.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? All in favor, please raise your hands. And. Okay, thank you. It's unanimous. So let's go on now to our Chief Human Relations Officer, Caitlin Harrison. She has an update on negotiations and a resolution for approving a union contract to ratify. So without Mike, do you want to introduce Caitlin, or did you have anything you wanted to say prior to that?
Well, brief introduction to thank Caitlin, members of the negotiating team on the Jefferson Healthcare end, and members of the negotiating team on the professional technical clinic nurses team on the union end. We did this at the tail end of one Delta surge and roaring through the Omicron surge. It was challenging circumstances, but I was incredibly impressed by how diligent and cooperative and just the good faith in every step along the process. Thanks to Caitlin and her work on our team, and a shout out to the members of the of the ProTech bargaining team too. It was a great process, and I think served everyone well. So with that, go ahead, Caitlin.
So I'm pleased to ask all of you to ratify the new ProTech Clinic contract. That particular unit actually has 79% of our employees who are in a bargaining unit, and has the diversity of everything from a dietary aid all the way through a pharmacist. So it's a unique contract in terms of every type of skill set, education level, and really does make up a tremendous amount of our team. So this year, we're proud to offer 4% pay increases in year one, 2.5% in year two, 2.5% in year three, with additional market increases. We actually reviewed every single job in the contract and did market and reviewed the market increases. And our negotiations team will tell you it was at times a mind-numbing process to go through all of our competitors' contracts, literally step by step. But it led all of us to feel really confident, and the union also contributed to that process and included some jobs that we were able to add to our market increases. We also increased premiums in several areas, including places like lead pay and for our surgical techs. We are proud to say that there is no wage lower than $15 for any position at Jefferson Healthcare, effective as part of this contract. Over the course of the contract between now and June 30th, 2024, we'll be moving recognition from 2-to-1 for the years of experience to 1-to-1. And that will be a process that happens with our goal of beginning our new contract completely finished with that. And then we were, and this is a huge thanks, including till 4 a.m. with our union partners. We were able to close this contract by the deadline of December 31st. And we're offering a negotiation completion bonus all the way back to 11-1. So I think our employees, we just got an email today from the union saying, which paycheck will they be in? So we're all really excited to be able to offer that, and couldn't be more impressed and proud of everyone who participated. As Mike mentioned, it takes both sides. And there was a commitment to things like 4 a.m. and working on holidays. We also had a couple COVID positives during the process, as well as a marriage during the process. So when I say people made a lot of sacrifices personally and professionally to make this happen, I really mean it. Tina is teasing me because we have a history with one of our negotiator or one of our partners team members. Who showed up one day during a UW Ohio State game 3 years ago wearing Ohio State gear around the Rose Bowl. For those of you who know Jake Davidson, nothing matters more to him, minus his kids and wife, than the Huskies. And so it began a trend. And I knew we were in a good place when the entire team on ProTech and Clinic showed up with Ohio State backgrounds in order to tease the team members for on the Jefferson Healthcare side. So our next steps on the RN contract, after 4 months and 16 bargaining sessions, to include also multiple sessions over the holidays and weekends that both all of our team members, you guys met Corey earlier, she's actually one of JH's negotiating, or one of our team members on the management side, gave up their holidays and their weekends, and we were unable to bring forward the contract today, but we mutually agreed to go to mediation. It's not a sign we don't believe we aren't going to get there. As a matter of fact, we are incredibly close. There's just a few items left, but we believe a neutral third party is going to be able to help us bridge that gap on the few items that we have left. So although in JH's historical history, we have not gone to a mediator, our attorney shared with us that more than half of the public sector hospitals do use mediation. We remain committed to the respectful tone that's been in all of our sessions, and also are very impressed with our RN partners, as well as our leadership team on both sides. And we look forward to coming back to you with a second ratification, hopefully sooner rather than later. And Mike, I don't know the formalities of asking for a ratification, so I'm sorry, Commissioner Bueller-Renster, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Caitlin. Mike?
Well, I think that there's a motion in the packet, isn't that right?
That is page 22 of your board packet. And what it says basically is, be it resolved that the chief executive officer is authorized to take all necessary administrative actions to implement this resolution and is authorized to execute the final contracts with UFCW 21. So while it's still in negotiation, we're authorizing Mr. Glenn to proceed and implement this resolution.
Well, actually, Jill, that we have there are two negotiations. This one is done, and this actually that it was done. And then it takes a couple of weeks to get reviewed and then prepped for a formal vote. And that vote took place yesterday, or Monday and Tuesday, Caitlin, and we learned today that it passed. So we were pushing this forward because this, we can't implement it until the board ratifies it. So this makes it go live. That there'll be, 500-600 union members very pleased about what happens sooner rather than later. If we can ratify it today. So that if it feels rushed, it's because it was a little, but we wanted to get it into this board process and the next possible paycheck.
That's okay. So the motion would be, Bruce, yes.
Yes. So my understanding then is that the resolution is just for this contract that has been approved by the members.
Yeah. Yep, exactly, Bruce.
So the motion would be to approve Resolution 2203, resolution of the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners approving the ProTech Clinic Collective Bargaining Agreement with United Food and Commercial Workers Local 21, UFCW 21.
So move.
Okay, Mari gets the motion. And Chris, I saw you, but you are muted.
Right, just trying to be quiet. Yes, second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? Okay, all in favor of ratification of this 2203, please raise your hand. Okay, thank you.
Thank you guys so much. We're very, very excited.
It was great negotiations. Thank you.
And thank you to all the ProTech workers and the clinic workers who help keep our patients safe and hopefully well.
Yep. And very, very focused on getting engaging with the mediator and clearing those final hurdles and presenting a completed and approved a contract to you as soon as possible as well.
Okay, now we will go ahead and continue with our quality report from our Chief Patient Safety and Quality Officer, Brandy Manuel. Brandy?
Thank you, Commissioner Bueller. And I would say the only thing more fun than going after Tina Toner as she shares such incredible stories about our staff is getting to go after Corey Quigley sharing her amazing story, and then after Tina Toner sharing stories about our incredible staff. So with that, I will go ahead and jump right in. As usual, we'll take a quick fly over our patient safety and quality goals, and then we'll dive down on one in particular. So most of this is reflective of third quarter. The core measures data is reflective of third quarter, and we continue to do quite well in most of our core measures. The one outlier continuing to be our ED throughput, though I am excited to say that in the last quarter, we actually saw that tick down a little bit, even in the setting of patient surges. So we're still a little higher than kind of where our target and our goal is, but seeing that come down in the face of kind of unprecedented volumes and boarding in the emergency department is pretty admirable. So a real shout out to our team in the emergency department. We did not have, in the month of December, we did not have any avoidable harm events. And the one that you will notice that is a little off-colored there is our workplace violence. And I just, we had a fall prevention meeting earlier this week, and Mitzi Hazard does a great job of leading that team. And our nursing leaders come together from all over the organization to talk about ways that we can prevent patients from having a fall, but if they fall, how can we make sure that they don't get hurt during that process? And I'm sharing this story because it all ties together. And I think that sometimes we don't appreciate that caring for our patients and keeping our patients safe is sometimes comes at the expense of our employees. And so one of our nursing leaders shared a story that she had a near miss. One of her employees had a near miss and was able to prevent a patient from falling, which is a great success story. She was right there at the bedside, was able to prevent that from happening, but in the process kind of lost situational awareness, and the patient ended up striking out at her. And it became a situation where, you know, we talk about this workplace violence as being something that we take very seriously, and just a really powerful reminder that sometimes our staff put themselves in harm's way to make sure that the patients are kept safe. So just a thank you to our caregivers who are at the bedside. So diving into this just a little more, again, I mentioned that we didn't have any preventable harm cases reported in the month of December, and core measures looked good overall. We did well with our composite stroke score at 95% compliance with all of the measures. We didn't have any reported early elective deliveries, which is our goal. So in that one, lower is better. Our compliance with our measures for the treatment of acute myocardial infarction or chest pain was 100%. And then our follow-up for normal colonoscopy was also 100%. So great job overall. And there we can see the ED throughput times, although they are still a little bit higher than we would like them to be, they have come down, and actually we're seeing that increase across the board. So hospitals across the country are experiencing the same thing. In terms of our patient experience data, this is again reflective of quarter three, the reason being that all of our fourth quarter surveys have not been returned yet. So we're still waiting on some of those. Those have remained pretty consistent. We've seen them dip down just a little bit. A lot of comments and tie into things that are COVID related, communication, visitor restrictions, those kinds of things.
Excuse me, Brandy. Could you comment on the number of deliveries that we've had in that we're having?
The number of deliveries is down overall, and I think Tina's on the line who could give us an accurate count. But I
think what it's 86 for the year last year.
Yeah. Yep. I was going to say, you know, in doing some of the quality abstractions, I was seeing about 6 to 8 deliveries a month.
It's down by 2 from the previous year. Yes.
Any other questions? All right. I wanted to take a minute to just highlight some really good work that happened over the last few months of 2021 with regard to our equity work. And you've heard us talk about how important it is to be able to identify areas where we have opportunity in raising the tide for our health outcomes for all patients. And one of the things that we identified early on was that perhaps the data were not accurate in terms of what we were collecting for demographic data. So with regard to race, ethnicity, and language data, otherwise known as real data, we were seeing that nearly all of our patients, according to the data, were white and English speaking. And we thought, well, maybe that's true, or maybe we're just not accurately correct collecting that information on the front end. So we did kind of a deep dive. And Jackie Levin worked really closely with Tisha Davidson and Alex Gee in Revenue Cycle. And they really did this incredible job of leading a team to dive into this topic and try to better understand what we were collecting and how often we were reassessing it with our patients. And what we found is that we actually were not asking questions about demographics. And if staff saw that there was data populated in the patient's record, they weren't reassessing it. So what that means is if I were to present for care somewhere, it's not likely that they would have asked me, what is my race, what is my ethnicity, and what is my language? And so Jackie, Alex, and Tisha spent time asking team members in different areas sort of for the why behind that. And it was kind of all over the place. But one of the things that really stood out to us is they didn't connect it to the why. They didn't know why that was important, first of all. And then also, they didn't want to offend anybody. So it was coming from a good place of really making sure that they weren't offending anybody or asking things that maybe they shouldn't ask. But also, they didn't want anyone to be put on the spot. So there was an assumption. I think one person said, well, I'm just assuming if they don't fill it in or if the patient doesn't respond to that question, it's because they don't want us to know. And so they were just kind of filling it in. And so that was a pretty powerful lesson. And so the team went to work and went ahead and created this curriculum to be able to really connect our staff to the why. And then standardize the training across the board for those employees who do kind of the intake with patients. And that was completed in the fourth quarter as part of a sprint with the Washington State Hospital Association. And Dunya and I got to present that in November on a national call with CMS, which was kind of exciting. So we're going to continue to build on that work and really advance it as we go. But definitely that team deserves props for all of the work that they did. I think it was a powerful lesson for us, and it's going to help us down the road better identify where we have opportunities to improve the quality and access to services. So next steps for our equity work is to continue this work that we just spoke of. We're going to focus on employee education. You know, hearing that staff were missing the connection to the why just really cemented that it's important that our employees and our leaders all understand and can make that connection. Why is it that we're talking about these things, and why is it that we're doing the work that we're doing? Planning is underway for Black History Month, which starts February 1st. And then we're also in the process of selecting our clinical quality measures that are related to equity for 2022. So lots of really fun and exciting work and meaningful work. And then I talked a little bit about where the data is on our service excellence or our patient experience work. And I wanted to, rather than put in lots of random quotes, which are always fun to read, we got a letter from a patient earlier last week, actually. And it was addressed to everybody I think most everybody on our website, which was amazing. And I didn't include any of the patient's personal information because that is her personal information. But I just really wanted to call it out because it was beautifully written and it really acknowledged each person, regardless of kind of where they're at in the organization, anywhere from registration to our ancillary teams, spoke of the providers that this patient had worked with. And this is just a very small piece of the overall 1.5 page letter that she sent. But I think it's worth calling out. This was an individual who had a serious health condition and came to us not knowing what to do and feeling kind of lost in terms of where she was going to go and how she was going to sort of move through that. And the team showed up for her in so many different ways. But in particular, we have one speech therapist, Megan, who was mentioned several times that went above and beyond for this particular patient. So I just wanted to spend a minute and share this story with you because I think it connects back to our why and why we do what we do every day and why it's such a privilege to be able to do it with the teams that we get to work with. And then a few other projects and focus areas for 2022. We launched our OB Quality Committee this week, which was really exciting and fun. We also started our Surgical Quality Committee, and we'll be pursuing hip and knee replacement certification through the DNV this year. So we're planning on making application towards the end of this year for that. We are starting a Patient Safety and Quality Leadership Council. So many of you have heard of our Executive Quality Council, which is kind of the place that all of the quality and safety and accreditation and compliance work kind of funnels up to. And our goal and our vision for 2022 is to better connect that work and better empower our leaders across the organization. So this will be kind of Executive Quality Council for our leadership team to come together, to share best practices, to identify places where maybe they're stuck and they need different resources or different ideas, to celebrate the wins where we have them, and to really encourage teamwork and collaboration across our organization. So I'm really probably most excited about that for this year. I mentioned the health equity already, and I think one of the other things, I won't read all of these to you, but one of the other things I wanted to really call out, you've heard me mention and sing the praises of our data team, who we lovingly refer to as DART, the Data and Analytics Reporting Team, and our DART team is phenomenal, and over the last 3 to 4 weeks, they have continued to feed us as much data as we request, almost, and because we are thirsty for data, we are always looking for more information about how we can do things better. But they've also been working with an outside agency to look at our infrastructure, to look at our technology, to look at the team skill set, and to identify sort of ways that we can bring that team together and really give them the tools to be even more effective in the future. So I'm really thinking about how to take data into the next phase for Jefferson Healthcare. And so that engagement is wrapping up, and we'll be reporting out at the Executive Quality Council. But I really had to acknowledge the work of that team. They have spent most of their days plugging away with this group, and they have been led by Dunya Foe and Josh Brocklesby, who've done just a really, really great job. So I wanted to call that out. We talked a little bit about accreditation, so we will be seeking another accreditation this year while continuing to maintain compliance with our other accreditation standards. And then we've talked a lot about our survey tools and the methodology for getting real-time survey data back, and that should be ready to go by the end of the first quarter. We've had a little bit of a delay. Providence is experiencing a little bit of a backlog, and we're working with them to get our files done. So we were hoping for February, and it's going to be probably March, but otherwise that is on track. And we're continuing to leverage MyChart and other methods of technology to better connect our patients to their care. So we're spending a lot of time looking at how to do that. And that's all I had. What questions do you have?
Any questions from the board? Thank you, Brandy. Awesome job as usual.
Yes. Excellent.
I do want to say it is truly remarkable the number of things that our quality program is tracking and doing. I mean, I look at that list and I go, how the hell can you keep it all straight? I mean, it's just mind-blowing. So just thanks.
Thank you. We have incredible people who many hands make light work or lighter work. So thank you.
Thank you, Brandy. All right, we will move on then to our financial report by our Chief Financial Officer, Tyler Freeman. Tyler.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So we are going to be going over both November and December. As you recall, we did not review November financials during the December board meeting because of the tight turnaround due to the holidays. So I'm going to go to the next slide. So first off, November, and since there, we're going over 2 months, there's a whole lot of numbers. I'll try and keep it high level and just point out a few things. So November overall stats were pretty good. We were 42% above budget for ICU patient days. So ICU was very busy. Also a lot of surgery cases and minutes. So surgery cases, 9% above budget, and minutes were 15% above budget. And the clinics and outpatient side of things were a little bit under, that was kind of to be expected with the holiday. We were looking really good at the beginning of the month, and then things kind of slowed a little bit down towards holiday time. And if you want to go to the next slide. So next slide, December. The stats started to trend a little bit down in December. You can see that surgery minutes, you know, dropped a lot. So we have a little bit of holiday impact along with some COVID impact happening in the month of December. So things slowed down a little bit, but the thing that I think is really interesting is if you look at that far right column is our variance year over year. So our 2021 numbers over 2020, those are some huge increases for the various departments. So 31% above our adjusted patient days. The ICU was 33% higher, 9% ACU. I mean, almost all categories were double-digit percentage higher than they were in 2020. In going down to the deeper level, there were a few departments that were lower than 2020. So I'll call those out. So we did end up with less swing bed days than we did in 2020. We're 31% below budget. We're 2% lower than budget for births. So births, we were at 88 for 2020, 86 in 2021. 2022 started with a boom. So maybe we'll end up back over 100 by the end of the year. We also were lower for budget for pulmonary rehab, occupational therapy, South County visits, dermatology, slightly lower for oncology, and then sleep clinic visits and studies. So for the most part, we beat our budget. For some of those areas, it was provider driven, people out on leave or missing the provider, and not necessarily a lack of volume from the community or lack of need for that service. So we did end up higher in all of our high level categories, but there's some specific departments where we're a little bit lower when you dig into the details. Then if you go to the next slide.
Quick question, Tyler.
Yep.
Those little bit lower numbers, are those within those categories that you described, or are any of those outside of those?
No, all of the ones that I described are the ones that were lower than budget.
Okay, are within that list that you gave. Yep. Thank you.
And so for November, we had a $1.7 million total change in net position. That was driven by being 5% higher than budget for gross patient service revenue. And we also had, that was the month that we received some different funding. So we got our ARP rural funds of $3 million in November. We recognize that over the next 14 months. So we have until the end of December 2022 to use those funds. So we asked our auditors if they agreed that we could recognize that revenue over the 14-month period instead of right away, because you technically have to use the funds or you lose them. You have to pay back PERSA. So we have not allocated our funds, saying that we have used them all yet. So we are going to recognize it over that 14-month period, which is about $220,000 per month. We also we had some of the similar issues we've had before with salaries and wages, high amounts of overtime, high amounts of professional fees, and high cost on supplies, which are just to be expected with the way that all hospitals are having to operate these days. If you move to the next slide.
Could I ask a question about the charity care adjustments?
Yeah.
Could you comment on that? It looks like the end of December, we were at minus 41%. Could you sort of explain what's
happening? Yeah, and we're on the December slide too. We ended up 41% higher. So the negative means that we had more charity care adjustments. So we were 41% higher for charity care overall for 2021 compared to our budget. So our budget for both charity care and uncollectible, which are those that the patient is responsible and we were unable to collect on that bill, those ended up at $14 million total, and we had budgeted $8 million. So a lot higher charity care and uncollectible throughout the full year of 2021. So both of those ended up quite a bit over budget. We also, for the full year, you know, same situation as the last one, salaries with overtime. Also, the provider incentive pay with the change to the new RVU methodology had some impact on having higher wages, but having a lower number of total bodies meant that we had less in employee benefits. We also had some people that have shifted, or as there's been some attrition and new folks start, some of those that have left have been part-time, and we've replaced them with full-time FTEs. And so for some of those positions, that's where you're seeing the employee benefit number drop a little bit. Having part-time employees and getting the same benefit is obviously more expensive for us. And then other expenses up for the same reasons I talked about, which are all expected: having more travelers, having to pay to get more supplies on hand, having a little bit higher of a stockpile than we would normally have, all contribute to having higher expenses. But overall, we still ended $2.7 million higher than our budget for the year. And so a piece of that is the 2020 cost report. We were expecting to get paid $2.3 million. We were paid $3.3 million by Medicare. So we had an additional $1.1 million roll through in 2021 that we had not accounted for in the previous year. We also had the $440,000 of the ARP rural funds that we recognized in 2021. And then we also had $365,000 worth of phase four funds that we received based on our lost revenues in December. So add all those things up, end up having 3% above budget for gross patient service revenue gets us to that $2.7 million above budget. It's pretty crazy that we almost made it all the way to $300 million in gross patient service revenue. That is a big number. That's almost $9 million higher than what we budgeted for. And to be at a 4.9% operating margin is also a good sign and something that we can definitely be proud of from a financial standpoint. And then go on to the next slide. So our cash position, cash can continue to climb. We need to actually make a modification to the way that we are displaying this, because we have these two lines, and the top line is the cash plus the Medicare advance payment. And the second line is just our cash. It's actual dollars that we have in the bank. The problem with just showing those two numbers is it discounts the fact that We expected at the end of the year to pay back CMS $4.6 million. So if you take that $4.6 million out, we're really at a, our top line would be 163 days cash on hand. Our second line would be 139. So still both really good numbers, a good place to be. But since we do have that payback that we expected at the end of the year, it does inflate those numbers a bit. So we really need to modify this slide to show it so that you're seeing that true expected cash number, because it can go the opposite way too. We could just as easily expect a huge receivable from CMS. And if we're calculating that, we're estimating it, we're getting pretty good at working with DZA and their tool to come up with our guess for what that's going to be. We should be making financial decisions with that extra amount, either in there or out of that number. So that'll be a change that you all will see in 2022. And then you can see the impact of that on the next, actually, I think it's a few slides from now. We've got the board financials first. So board financials, nothing of note for November. And then if you go to the December on the next slide, it's got it. Where we expected to be. So there was the additional audit fees related to the single audit. And then, under budget, a lot of that is because there was less consulting fees, less travel meetings, trainings, all of those things to be expected based on how things went in 2021. And then the next slide is the one that I was talking about, where you can kind of see that impact. So first off, the charges in January sitting at 91% of budget, that's a decent spot to be in. We usually, January is a little bit lower of a month, so being at 91%, I'm comfortable with that. We smooth the budget out over the days. We don't adjust for any seasonality, and there is a little bit of seasonality. We typically underperform the budget in the month of January, so only being 9% less is not a bad place to be in. And then the cash collections are what look odd, and the reason for that is, as I mentioned, we were expecting to have to pay Medicare back $4.6 million. They sent us a letter in December saying that we owed them over $3 million, $3.8 million, and so we tried to pay that in the month of December, but CMS being CMS, we couldn't get a hold of them, couldn't get the information we needed, tried to send an ACH payment. They didn't accept what we tried to send them, and so they have been recouping from our what would be going through our remittances throughout the month of January. So we haven't actually received a single payment from CMS since January 5th. So when you see a cash number of $285,000, that's basically missing all of the payments that would have been coming from Medicare since January 5th. And they'll continue to just recoup through those what would be our usual remittances until the full $3.8 million is paid.
As the CEO of the hospital, I am going to point out the irony of a hospital complaining about the difficulty of paying a bill. Anyone else catch that?
Yes.
Crazy. Yeah, we tried to pay it in December because we just wanted a nice, clean break from 2021 into 2022. We knew they were going to do the recoupments anyways if we didn't pay it. So we wanted to get it done before year end, but they wouldn't take it. It was not for lack of trying. Sasha spent a lot of time on the phone with Noridian trying to get this figured out.
I assume there's no interest on that delayed payment.
Nope.
Too bad it didn't expire on the 31st and they couldn't come after us later.
Yeah, it would be nice to keep the 3.8.
Any questions for Tyler?
Yes, I do. The 3.3 million received instead of 2.3. Is there any likelihood of them trying to claw that back next year?
So they do. After they settle cost reports, they typically do audits of them, more thorough audits and reviews, and they will try and claw back as much as they can. We typically haven't had a lot of issues with audits in the past. They do have 3 cost report years open with us right now. They just reopened 2017, so they're looking at what they paid us for 2017 to make sure that we don't have to pay them back. And they're specifically auditing our Medicare bad debt and charity care to make sure that we checked all the boxes. Because since they pay us 65 cents on the dollar, those are audited really frequently. And even after they close the settlements, they frequently will reopen, test another sample and see if they can find something and have you pay them back. So it's not uncommon, but we don't expect anything. And typically the reason why that ended up being higher, we've had a constant practice of only booking 80% of the of our estimate, good or bad. So if we estimate a payback, we estimate 80%. If we estimate a receivable, we estimate it at 80%, just to be a little conservative.
My other comment would be congratulations to guest accounts receivable, 44.1 days. A lot of hard work going on there and much appreciated by me, certainly.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you, Tyler. Great report and good work.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, we'll go to our Chief Executive Officer, Mike Glenn, for the admin report.
All right, next slide, please, Alyssa. And next slide, that data is a little old, so I'm just gonna go to the next slide. Perfect. Primary care and specialty clinics. Given what's going on in the community, very busy, I think, the challenge in a period of high community prevalence is seeing the high numbers of patients that are coming in not necessarily seeking COVID care, but doing that in a safe way and being able to communicate to all of our patients that we are isolating our COVID care from our non-COVID care. So I think given what the community is going through, the fact that we're at that level of budget is remarkable, in addition to the staffing challenges that our employees who live in this community of heightened COVID prevalence are managing themselves and their families. Specialty clinics, a little bit higher volumes. Mostly because it less discretion in many cases when you are seeing a specialist and a primary care provider. Next slide. Oncology infusion continues to stay busy at north of 90%. And then you can probably guess when the governor's proclamation went into effect. And this is about what we expected. I will say, though, how the purpose of the proclamation was to free up staff from surgery suites. So in theory, doing elective cases, the prohibition with elective cases, you wouldn't be doing as many cases, and those nurses and CNAs and such could be relocated to other parts of the hospital. Good theory, a little bit more challenging to implement because you certainly couldn't take a very skilled OR nurse and have them work on the OB unit. But Donica has done a great job of making her team available where they can be available, and the ACU is a good example. So how we complied with this, we usually run three lines of surgery on any given day. We reduced that to one line, which we thought was the most efficient and consistent with the governor's intention as possible. Dr. Jafari and Dr. Harris are working with Donica and Tina in evaluating the cases and making sure that they are indeed complying with the governor's proclamation. And there is a little bit of clinical discretion on particularly under the exemption of avoiding harm. But it's an extra step, and we are all looking forward to when we can do more cases, because the amount of non-emergent but necessary cases that we need to do for our community continues to stack up. So Tina and Dr. Harris, I think in the next week or so, are going to engage Dr. Jafari in a role of chief of surgery about what that ramp up looks like, because we want to do that safely and efficiently and begin to take care of the backlog of patient care. But anyway, great partnership with surgeons and the surgery team, and Donica's on every the call at 8:15 every morning, where we talk about census and staffing, and has jumped in on several occasions to help where she can. So you're going to see that number jump up here in a couple of weeks. Next slide, please. This is the emergency department and express clinic volumes. It's not uncommon to see those numbers, particularly express clinic, drop a bit when access to primary care increases due to either staffing availability or something else. And primary care has been doing a great job recently, always, but really leaning into this work recently to take care of as many patients as possible. You know, it is when you have such high community prevalence, and particularly with the Omicron variant, where so much of it is asymptomatic or light symptomatic, we do have to be very mindful about making sure that to the extent possible, we're isolating COVID-related care from non-COVID-related care for all kinds of reasons, but mostly is because we want to promote that to our patients, that this is a safe clinic, and we do a good job of managing the COVID risk in these clinics. So shout out to the Express Clinic and the emergency department and the primary care team working together. Next slide, please. So I wanted to give you an advocacy update, and the other bullet is Dunia. As I mentioned earlier, Dunia's role has expanded to population health advocacy and analytics, which Brandy spoke of a little bit, and you've heard me say this on a couple of occasions. Eric Lewis used to say that you can manage everything you can manage at your hospital really well, but if you don't pay attention to what's going on in Olympia or Washington D.C., you can get crushed. So I think we've done a reasonable job over the years paying attention to DC and Olympia, but I think going forward we need to be more engaged and more involved. So we spoke of the meetings that we were scheduling with our legislative delegation, and in this case it was a meeting with Representative Therringer and a meeting with Senator Vandeweghe's legislative assistant, Peter Stillquist. And those meetings were our meetings, so we controlled the agenda and talked through gave them a copy of the letter that you approved, and we talked through those issues and spent some time talking about the issues that were both on our list and wishes list. As Jill and Mari will attest, this week the Washington State Hospital Association have they're coordinating this virtual advocacy days. So in the past, we'd go to Olympia and shuffle around the legislature and the Capitol building and jam 15 people in these tiny legislative offices and do our advocacy. This time it was via Teams. And actually last year it was clunky and people talked all over each other and didn't work very well. This year it's actually worked pretty well. And we had a great meeting with Representative Chapman and spoke about the issues that are most near and dear to WSHA, the staffing bills, improving the process to discharge difficult to discharge patients, fund additional nursing school slots to increase the nursing and MA and CNA pipeline to meet today's crisis, which is estimated to be over 6,000 RNs in Washington State right now, and also down the road. So strong messaging with respect to that. So we will continue to participate in WSHA scheduled meetings, and then we're we are a little bit more deferential about the agenda. But we, in addition to that, we are reaching out and scheduling Jefferson Healthcare only meetings with our legislative delegation. And, you know, it continues to amaze me how busy they are, but they not only make time for us but they make time for Olympic and Summit Pacific and Grace Harbor. And are truly interested in mostly doing no harm. That if we tell them a bill could hurt us, they engage and they want to work with us to figure out a way to where it can work. So this is going to be a regular agenda item, and I'm going to ask Dunya going forward, and I did ask Dunya to speak today to just sort of give a riff on kind of all things advocacy as we are beginning this work. So, Dunya, are you out there?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Thanks, Mike. Yes, so exactly what Mike said. We had our individual meetings that we talked about last week, and then this week has been WSHA meetings, which it was far less chaotic than it was last year. But to just give you an idea, we had all five hospitals represented from our district, which is incredible that all five hospitals were able to send representatives there to these meetings. And actually, the representatives Chapman and Theringer gave us longer than our 15-minute allotment. So that was really helpful for us to get through all the issues, because there are a lot this year. We have reached out and we've scheduled follow-on meetings with both of the representatives and our senator for the coming weeks that are Jefferson Healthcare driven. That being said, we're in pretty close communication with OMC and other hospitals, as well as WSHA, to just make sure we're on the same message, but making sure that our hospital needs and perspective are really being heard as an individual. A lot of this is so operational. I've had the pleasure of working more closely with Tina Toner than I think she was expecting this year, as we think through things like nurse staffing and really using that on the ground experience, because that's where I think the representatives and the senator, they need our perspective. They've never run hospitals before, and getting her involvement and potentially others' involvements around what it means on the ground, how are these going to be operationalized by the hospitals themselves, is critical for them to understand the impact that all of this can have on us. That being said, we are almost halfway through, not quite, a really short session. And so we're just continuing to watch things really, really closely and are readjusting our strategy as needed.
Great. Thank you. So she'll be a regular part of the advocacy going forward. It's going to be something that we just don't turn on and turn off when we need to, but just regularly work it, because I do think it has a strong impact on operational success. Next slide. Oh, Case, do you have a question? You're muted there.
Yes, with regards to our plans for implementing the master plan and the at what stage do you see that it would be good to get them specifically up to speed with that? Because that's going to be a big ask and a big issue, and yes. Seems to me to get them on board in one way or another fairly soon might be appropriate.
Yep, great question. We in talking with our the folks that we are working with that are trying to detect grant opportunities, both federal and state and state budget allotments and federal budget allotments, we decided that next year's budget for the, at the state level will be the year we make a pitch. And included, there's a new hospital project, replacement hospital project going on in Moses Lake now. They are about a 6 to 12 months ahead of us in their planning process. And they worked with their legislative delegation, and they got a $4 million carve out included in the governor's budget just for that, for the purpose of that hospital. Now, getting something in the budget versus, spending it are two different things. But when we met with Steve and Peter Steelquist in Kevin's office, we said, hey, we need to let you know that we are embarking on this replacement project. It could be a real big deal or just a medium sized deal. Either way, we're going to be coming to you with our hats in our hand, asking for financial support at the state level and your support in soliciting our federal delegation as well. So we planted the seed, but you're right, Case. It's gonna require a lot of cultivation. Okay, next slide, please. I had a great meeting with Lori and Apple. Seems like it was just yesterday, but I think it was it was shortly after our last board meeting. To just get an update on CHIP and where it was going. And they provided a CHIP update, about a 10-12 page document that we are making available to you. And I've decided that it would do a disservice to all of the work CHIP is doing for me to try to shoehorn it into my presentation. So I'm going to ask Lori and Apple and maybe even Dr. Barry to come to the February or March meeting and bring us all up to speed. But what I did want to share with you is the operational transition of Lori and John Nowak being co-directors to just Lori being the director has been made, and we are very pleased with that. Lori's been a great partner, and she and John really complemented each other, but I think Lori watching John's ability to integrate groups and facilitate meetings, that I think she's going to be powerful at that too. And Dr. Barry has, as we all know, is the county health officer, and she will be filling Dr. Locke's shoes, not only in pandemic management, but also in the community health assessment and the community health improvement plan work. And as you recall, before we had a pandemic, that's how we used to interface with the public health officer. So that's what the leadership will look like. The other transition that I think Case may be able to speak to is they are recommending that Jefferson County Public Health Board becomes CHIP's governing body. And I think this makes sense because, as you recall, the super governing body that we did have called for the hospital board, the county commissioners, and the city council to all get together. And those were challenging to pull off and sometimes just difficult to administrate. But certainly served the purpose of speaking to a broad party. In Clallam County, the Public Health Board is the governing body for CHIP. And when they suggested that to me, I asked, well, was Case involved in the discussion? And said that you were. And I said, well, Case could probably discuss this at our board's level, but it seemed like a reasonable thing. So Case, do you want to speak to that? I'm kind of putting you on the spot.
But that's okay. First of all, there does seem to be support from the Board of Health for this. I think it's appropriate to say there's also been there will be a dramatic change in the composition of the Board of Health. As some of you may recall, the legislature last year passed a bill that basically changes the kind of representation that is allowed and required on boards of health. And so we are looking at having 8 members effective, I think it's either in June or July, and actually the board is allowed to have only 4 elected officials going forward. 3 of those will be the county commissioners. 1 of them will be the elected representative from the city council. And this year it's going to be Libby Erner Wenstrom. And then the other 4 positions are going to require at least 1 representative from a tribal unit in the region. And it's not clear yet which tribe and or whether there will be 1 or 2. Going forward, starting in June or July, there will no longer be an official representative from Jefferson Healthcare. Jefferson Healthcare's representative on the board is not considered a, quote, elected position. The law pretty much specifies that the elected positions are city and county. I would be taking the place of one of the requirements is somebody from the health professions and or public health professions. So they have asked me to fill the shoes of that category. And so, and we can talk about that more when it comes to our committee assignments. But the specifics of how this governance transition would work hasn't been fully discussed yet at the Board of Health because we spent a lot of time talking about the change in composition and a few other issues and electing of a new chair and vice chair. And I can report more on that later. So I don't have any more specifics other than just to say that there does seem to be support from the current board to take this on. It makes logical sense.
All right. Well, when that gets a little bit more fleshed out, we'll make the presentation here. But that's how I viewed it too. And lastly, consistent with the other partners of CHIP, and I think what we have committed to in the past, our financial contribution to CHIP going forward in 2022 will be $25,000 that administratively we will do. But good discussion. Lori's not going to miss a beat. More responsibility for her, but I'm looking forward to working with Lori Apple and Dr. Barry, and you know, and where we can be talking about something other than you know antigen tests for PCR tests and test rate per for 10,000 residents. That concludes my report. Dr. Mattern is standing by to give a COVID update. So, Joe, it's
yours. Yes. Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mike. And we will go, if there's no other questions for Mike or comments, then we will go to you, Dr. Mattern, for a COVID update. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, Mike used the key phrases antigen, PCR tests, and cases per 100,000. So I knew that was my cue to get ready and jump in here. So I will just kind of walk you through a little bit of the current situation. I think you probably have a good sense of kind of where things are at, but I'll go through kind of the current prevalence and trends, and we can talk a little bit about capacity and employee health through this. So, and as always, you can stop me and with any questions, or at the end, then we can go over anything that you're hearing or kind of wondering about. So I think probably the good news on Monday, if it we're going to keep our fingers crossed and it holds true, was the sense from our county health officer that maybe Jefferson County is hitting our, or has passed our COVID peak for the Omicron wave. If you were following the case rates per 100,000 per 14 days, the previous week we had been, about 2 weeks ago, we were over 1,400, and as of Friday, we were slightly below 1,400. Now, the numbers, of course, keep in mind, are still quite high overall, but we're starting to see a trend. I will give you the subjective perspective, which is that because of our self-swab procedure, a lot of the results end up in my in-basket. So, how much I wince when I log on to Epic and look at my result basket to see how many tests have been run and how many positives. So I winced less the last couple days. So that's good. I do think that we're seeing a slight trend down, but it is important to understand that. Still a high number of cases. What we're seeing in general of the results today, and I've been looking through, we do kind of a screening to see how many high-risk folks are testing positive, people who we might think might end up in the hospital or be kind of higher risk. And we're seeing a lot of people ages 10 to 50, I would say, is kind of what the last couple of days have looked like. Not, again, uncommon to see households where you're seeing, possibly a student or a child who has is positive, and then you're seeing some parents or other household members. So, similar to what we've seen, we do have a few COVID patients in-house. So I think, again, important to remember that while everyone talks about how Omicron is a milder disease, the key is that it is milder than Delta, but it is still a severe disease, and we still have people hospitalizing. We still are being hospitalized, and we still have people dying daily in Washington and across the country. So the death toll is still is going to be significant from the Omicron wave. Good news, probably in some neighboring counties that are important for us to pay attention to. Clallam County has struggled for the last few weeks, particularly with regard to staffing of their hospital. Luckily, they're starting to get some folks back. So we think some of the staffing difficulties they've had is stabilizing a little bit. You may be aware that we accepted some patients from Olympic Medical Center in the last couple of weeks to try to help out. That's not a typical transfer relationship, but important for the North and Olympic Peninsula for us to be collaborative with one another. And we were fortunate enough to have some capacity, though. Our own capacity is tricky. I think currently we have 3 COVID patients in the hospital at this time. We have not seen as many people requiring intensive care, but we have seen people get still very sick during this wave. So again, don't just because we're seeing less of this doesn't mean that we're not seeing people who still require quite a bit of care overall. Probably the best news in our local area is looking at the King County numbers in the last 14 days, which if you go to the King County Public Health website and their COVID data, really showing a significant drop in cases over the last 14 days. So hopefully that is going to herald what we're going to see across the state. I do think it's important to understand that there is the trends right now are that the eastern part of the state is still on the upward trend in some eastern counties. So they may peak before the western part of the state. So a couple things to keep in mind. Hospitalizations take longer to clear out, after the cases peak. So hospitalizations will peak after, and they will come down slower. So our hospital capacity, particularly for transfers, is going to take a little longer after the cases peak for the Puget Sound corridor for the hospitals to have more capacity, both from staff and both from fewer patients, particularly COVID patients, which make about 30% of the patients clearing out. So, and then the other complicating factor, which could extend it further for us, is if Eastern Washington is overwhelmed, our patients, even if we're kind of in a better place, our, neurology patients, our cardiac patients, our folks that we can't keep here, we may be competing for a couple more weeks beyond that with Eastern Washington patients if they don't have the capacity on the eastern side. So it's just important to know that once, the community, people will say, hey, cases are down, and I can already hear it through the school, having a teenager in school who says, hey, everyone's back again, people are back in class. So I sense the general sense may be the community be like, oh, we've peaked. Well, from a healthcare standpoint, our peak is not there yet. The sort of challenges that we're going to be facing, it's important to understand, are probably going to last through February, and it's important for us to be prepared for that. So this best case scenario is things are lightening up kind of middle of next month, but realistic to think that things may be difficult through the end of February. But there is some light at the end of the tunnel. One of the things that's happened, so just to talk a little bit about COVID testing, Mike made reference to PCR versus antigen testing. Supply chain, again, has become a problem with all these cases. And so huge kudos to the laboratory and to our materials management and supply teams who are constantly keeping track of multiple shipments of, reagent from here, swabs from there, test kits from here. So we're really kind of putting together, testing that's for the community, but then also very importantly through this surge has been testing for employee health to keep people at work and to identify people who have potentially had exposures. And so that's, we've been relying more on the antigen testing. So the tests that take 10 to 15 minutes to do don't have to be sent off or put in a machine. Supplies of those, we kind of keep, track, a shipment is supposed to arrive and we wait and it doesn't show up one day and it shows up the next day. And so we just got 250 kits arrived today. So that kind of gives us a little relief because we're really relying on some of these tests to keep people who are vaccinated and boosted who might have had an exposure, whether we're concerned there could have been a potential exposure at work or exposure in the community. We can keep some of these people working if they are feeling well and they're testing negative with our testing regimen. We take a very conservative approach. I think it's important to know when you look around the community and you hear around the country, I should say, and you hear stories of people sending healthcare workers back to work very, shortly after testing positive for the virus, or sometimes going back sick in, crisis standards of care. We are trying to stay as close to conventional standards of care as possible from a conventional staffing standpoint. So we're trying to keep people home when possible, only in some very tight staffing situations. We have people who might have an exposure who are vaccinated and boosted and not having symptoms who we can test regularly, we may have them in. But the testing is a key component of that. So these antigen tests are very important for us. We are anticipating antigen tests to distribute to the community We have put in orders with the federal government. We're hoping that these pallets of test kits are going to show up. We'll work with our public health partners to talk about the best way to make use of those tests in the community. But right now, the antigen testing that we're getting right now is primarily focused on keeping the hospital and the medical center running and operational, and keeping our staff safe to make sure that we're not having people here who are, you know, turning positive after an exposure. So hopefully we're going to see some stabilization of the testing supplies come through. Just around the employee health standpoint, you've probably seen that with the increased number of cases in the community, increased number of exposures, we've gone to some automatic web-based and QR code-based processes, which have been really helpful to gain some efficiency. So staff can use a QR code to report a potential exposure and get some guidance. And that has, thanks to the IT team who helped put that together pretty rapidly. And that's been extremely helpful. We've also, just so folks know, we've taken some folks who had other positions and we've that we were able to kind of reallocate, and we've provided additional staffing to employee health through this time, because this is sort of our number one priority is, again, keeping our staff safe, keeping the medical center going, because we can't close the hospital. So that has kind of come together pretty nicely. Still making different, you know, tweaks to the workflows and some of the processes as things come up. But I think we're in a pretty good position right now. A lot of that is based on testing. So as long as our testing supplies and antigen testing and PCR testing capacity is maintained, then I think I feel pretty good about where we're at. It's also important for you all to know that from a supply standpoint, while testing supplies have been problematic, we've been doing quite well from standpoint of PPE. Remember when that was in the beginning of the pandemic, that was a big concern. So just to let you know, we've encouraged people to move more to N95 mask use. So even when we're not doing aerosol generating procedure, particularly people who are patient facing, we've made more use of N95s for people, even using some of the masks for greeters and registration and other roles. If people feel more comfortable, given the more contagiousness of the Omicron variant. So we're much more liberal in that use, and we've got the supply to do that. We're also much more liberal in what we consider an exposure. Remember the whole 6 feet away, 15 minutes, cumulative over 24 hours as far as an exposure. We look at that, but in some situations, for example, if we have someone who's tested positive and they shared a break room space, we may just consider the break room as the exposure, not whether there was 6 feet apart, because we understand that Omicron can, you know, potentially linger in the air. And we'll err on the side of extra testing in that situation. I just want you to know that we are taking a very conservative approach with staff around potential exposures. We'd rather err on the side of testing, and the staff, quite frankly, has let us know. So, like, we'd rather err on the side of a testing, and as long as we can keep the supplies going, that's what we're going to do. Keep your fingers crossed that we can do that. And again, if we're passing the peak in Jefferson County, that's very good from a staffing standpoint. But again, we're dealing with things like we have another daycare outbreak, and that even when we don't have employees who are testing positive, we have employees who have to stay home because they lose their child care. And so we've seen some of that even when we haven't had the employee having a positive test from a community transmission. Again, within the hospital transmission, we're just not seeing. I'm going to knock on wood. Case, you have a question?
Yeah, about the in-hospital transmission. I've noticed that there's a great report we get every week about the number of employees who have tested positive, and yet I'm struck by how few of them actually have the contact within the hospital setting. So just to make sure that people understand that, I think you can almost count them on one hand in the long period of time, the number who have acquired the infection in the hospital.
Yeah, it's really been, again, I'll knock on multiple sources of wood, I think it's a testament. It's not just luck. You need a little luck with this. I mean, there's, because I think I've said before with this group, which is that with a really contagious virus, you can do everything right and still, you know, you can get an exposure that slips through the cracks. But I think the combination of taking a more conservative approach, the education of the staff, the buy-in, trying to make testing readily available, the continual education around PPE, huge thanks to Laura Showers, huge thanks to the PPE Council and the representatives from the departments who stay engaged in talking about sort of what's working, what's not, what do we need to do better. You know, our eye protection is, you know, kind of an example of this. So a local hospital had an outbreak among their healthcare workers, and it was a healthcare exposure, and it was around eye protection. Omicron, because of its contagiousness, not having the proper eye protection, and an aerosol procedure was done, and staff in the room were wearing masks, N95 masks, but they ended up contracting, and they targeted back to this one patient room, and the common factor was not wearing eye protection. Well, eye protection has been a battle for us, mostly because it's hard to find something that's comfortable, that works well, that doesn't have glare. And so, you know, even 2 years in, I think I would say that we probably have finally found our best eye protection solution. So there's a product called Stoggles that has become extremely popular. And once the staff said, hey, it's easy for me to wear these, this is much better. I don't forget to put them on, or I don't take them off because they're uncomfortable. And so what do? We invest in them. It's an investment, because you're investing in your employee safety. And that's the kind of feedback with the PPE Council that we get. And again, I think it goes back to why have we been successful in keeping our employees safe and reducing the risk of kind of transmission within the walls. And I think it's that kind of engagement of the staff and all the teams. So good to know for the community to know that the biggest risk for our employees is really outside the walls. It's the community transmission so far, but we still can't let our guard down. I do want to say a few things about treatment, because I know I think last time we talked, I kind of said, hey, this is coming, which is the COVID treatments, which is two pills that are antivirals and a new monoclonal antibody. We have received those medications, and I believe Safeway Pharmacy also has one of the antiviral medications in a limited number of treatment courses, so for a limited number of patients. Those treatments right now are heavily restricted because of just the sheer volume of tests that you've got. It's just we don't have many tests we don't have that many treatments. And that's across the country, not even just across Washington State or across our, you know, the North Olympic Peninsula. So as a result, these treatments are reserved for the highest risk individuals, highest risk for hospitalization and death. The use of these medications is a bit more complicated. The monoclonal antibody that we have, the emergency department is familiar with the use, and so we're working with them to make use of the newer monoclonal antibody. So they were using REGEN-COV and bamlanivimab earlier in the pandemic. Now for Omicron, it's sotrovimab is the antibody which is most appropriate. We're also working with the birth center, because that is for pregnant women who are who test positive, or particularly who are unvaccinated. That is probably the most appropriate treatment for them. And so we're currently working on the final processes to administer that treatment at our birth center for appropriate patients. There's a 7-day window for the sotrovimab after onset of symptoms or testing positive. The antiviral medications actually have a 3-day window. So this is a very, very narrow window. The authorization is for a 5-day, but again, through the Department of Health and our local health officer, they've asked to narrow that window to 3 days because they want the highest risk individuals and they want the highest effectiveness. The operationalizing prescribing these medications, it's not so simple as, hey, we have a medication now, you tested positive, I'll just prescribe it. There are some problems and difficulties with the medication, particularly the most effective one, which is Paxlovid. It is a combination of two antiviral medications, and one of them is notorious for interactions with other medications. So it's indicated for people who are high risk. So these are people who oftentimes are on a number of medications, cardiac medications, psychotropic medications. So we can't simply just say, hey, you know, the nurse calls you, you tested positive, go take this for 5 days and, you know, all's good. They really need proper guidance, and they need someone to look at them clinically and look at their existing conditions, look at the medications they're on, and prescribe and say, this is the benefit of this outweighs the risk to it. Or if we're going to do it, we're going to need to make some modifications to the medications that you're taking. I need you to kind of maybe not take this medication for a few days or to reduce a dose. So in combination with pharmacy, and we have a couple of our primary care physicians who have agreed to be kind of the initial consultants for this medication. So we're finalizing our process. We're making it so that people who test positive can see if they're eligible for the medication, so that their triage of their positive results can come to the top of the heap, so that they can be triaged by the COVID nurse and then also gain timely consultation. So far, because of the population who's been testing positive in the last week, we're not seeing folks who would qualify yet, either because they're high risk but they've tested outside that 3-day window, or because there are lower risk individuals. So having said that, I think we need to get ready with this process, because I think at some point the 3 days is going to extend to 5, and the population that's going to be available to is going to open up. So I just want you in the community, if you're hearing, hey, are your doctors prescribing these COVID medications? I think it's important to give them the messaging, as it's a little more complicated. It's very heavily restricted. And when we do it, we need to do it safely. And that we're currently finalizing the process and the education for our staff and teams to do this. So in the future, at some point, I think these medications will be very much a medication that most clinicians will feel comfortable prescribing once there's some increased education, more availability. And so I think it's something that ultimately will look a lot like influenza treatment in the future. So for those of you who are familiar with prescriptions for Tamiflu, which is the flu medication, which is typically prescribed by primary care providers or urgent care providers or even specialty providers. But in the short run, it's going to be a narrow group who's going to be prescribing before we kind of expand it across staff. And so the most important thing to know about treatment is the best treatment is the one that's not needed. And so just a reminder again of the effectiveness of vaccination. Also on the King County website, they actually have the difference between vaccinated and unvaccinated outcomes for King County. And they actually have their data broken down, even where you can just look at just the Omicron surge. And what's interesting is that before the Omicron surge, being unvaccinated before the Omicron surge, you had 11 times the risk of death from COVID compared to the vaccinated individuals. Well, since the Omicron surge, it's actually 19 times. So those numbers are smaller, so maybe that will come back to 11. But I think the important thing to understand is that still, vaccination, particularly with booster, is highly protective against severe illness, hospitalization, and death. And so people, a significant portion of folks have not gotten their booster. Actually, Jefferson County has been quite better than the national average. But it's important for us to continue to emphasize with folks, if they think that this is peaked, I don't need to get my booster now. The answer is no. Still get booster. It's going to be around. You know, again, don't anticipate that COVID's going to be gone. And we also don't know, could there be a future variant or, you know, something, what comes after Omicron? So I hate to say it, but it's always possible. So, and then, so moving forward, I think the biggest things now Mike kind of hinted at is capacity. So I think dealing with the late effects of the Omicron surge just on getting staff back, you know, across the region. You know, hospital beds have not been the problem. Hospital staff has been, combined with COVID cases. So hopefully we'll see COVID cases go down. We'll see staff come back. The biggest concern for staffing is not going to be COVID infections if there's not another variant or surge. It's going to be sort of mental, physical capacity. People are tired. It's, you know, even I always count us lucky because we haven't had the kinds of cases of COVID patients in the hallways and in tents in the parking lot and that kind of experience. But the fatigue of our staff and having to take extra shifts and cover and just what they've had to deal with in their life outside of work, you know, I've said it multiple times, you know, people are really worn down and it's particularly worse, I think, outside of Jefferson County, but it's kind of bad all over. And so really one of the huge challenges for, you know, for the country is going to be all these needs post, you know, post COVID wave needs of, you know, again, care that needs to be caught up on. Individuals who have survived COVID but have lingering disability, which is significant, and a medical system that has really kind of wilted under the weight of the whole pandemic. So, all right, I'll stop there. I probably should have ended on a cheerier note than that, but let's see what questions you have.
Questions for Dr. Manor? Laurie?
Sorry, Joe, I might have missed it, but the treatments, are they're restricted because of supply or because of
supply?
Supply, okay.
Yeah, it's really about supply. So just to give you an idea, I mean, we got 20 courses of treatment, you know, to us, and I think Safeway got 20 courses of treatment. And I think when they looked at kind of, you know, how many cases there are initially, they really wanted to make sure that the most severe cases were getting it. Now, I think it's so restricted, editorial comment here, I think it's almost, it may be a little too paralyzing. I think there's going to need to be some, you know, particularly in some communities to say, you know, hey, we're not using it at all. But if you open up a 5-day window or you say, we, you know, we're a little bit more flexible on kind of the risk factors. Because when it was studied, it was a little bit, it's authorized for a broader group. It's still high risk, but it's certainly authorized to be used in a broader group than what we're doing. But it's restricted right now through public health officials because they needed to see how that supply would be used initially. So I anticipate that there'll be some liberalization of it, but it's really about supply right now, about why it's more restricted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Manor. And as usual, it's very pertinent, important, and interesting information. Thank you very much for taking the time to share that with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, if there are no further comments or questions, then we'll thank Dr. Manor and we'll go on then to board business. So, Case, will you please report on the Board of Health meeting?
Sure, just very briefly, that the new chair of the Board of Health is Greg Brotherton, and I have offered to be the vice chair this year. As I mentioned earlier, the composition will change in the late spring, according to the state legislature. Our meeting, we talked mostly about Omicron last week and some of the same things that Dr. Mattern shared. There's also, we're beginning to consider the whole CHIP proposal. And then that's really pretty much it. We've decided to put the topic of the climate crisis, which is something that we wanted to deal with and its health effects. We've decided to put that on hold for a couple more months until we things calm down a bit with regards to the Omicron pandemic, the COVID pandemic, and the change in our board composition.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Kauf, Dr. Kauf? Okay, then we do have some action items. First is adoption of the board book, pages 23 to 26 in your packet. If you've had a chance to look through it and see, if you're happy with the changes that were made.
So move.
Second.
All right, discussion. All in favor of adoption of our board book, please raise your hand. Okay, that's unanimous. Thank you. The next one is adoption of the 2022 board calendar. Is there a motion to accept the calendar?
So moved.
Okay, it's moved and seconded. Any questions or comments on it? Okay, then everybody in favor, raise your hand, please. Okay, unanimous. And then the 2022 committee assignments, they were emailed to you from Melissa today. Basically, they're the same as last year with just a couple of changes. Does anyone have any questions about it? Any comments?
Yeah, my comment would be, it seems that cases are natural for the Board of Health. And so I'm really happy with that because he's done a really good job this last 20 months. And if you've got an expert, why not make them use their expertise?
Absolutely. He's ready made for that.
Yeah, perfect.
All right. If there's no further discussion, is there a motion to approve?
So move.
Okay. Second?
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor, please raise your hand. Okay, unanimous. Then any other board business? Yes, Case.
Yeah, just a few comments. I think I mentioned at our last meeting that the leader did not publish my letter to the editor. I couldn't find it online. But when I got the printed copy, in fact, they had published my letter to the editor.
Yes.
I had already drafted a letter to the editor to the PDN because I was afraid that the leader would not publish it. And I just found out that they will be publishing a similar, though different letter, basically thanking our staff for all their work and the fact that they need our support and appreciation. So it's in the same vein as the letter published by the leader last week. And then finally, a quick note that the East Jefferson Fire Rescue is going through a strategic planning process probably next month. And I've been invited by Dave Seabrook and Deborah Stinson, two of the board members of East Jefferson Fire Rescue, to participate in their strategic planning effort, not as a representative of this board, but just as a person in the community who's been here a while and been involved in a variety of issues. I mentioned this to Mike Glenn. I might have mentioned it to you too, Jill, a month or two ago. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem that there was a problem of a conflict of interest. And if, in fact, this goes through, I will make sure that I am not seen as a representative of Jefferson Healthcare.
I think it'd be a very good addition to that. It's my personal opinion.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions, comments about board business before we go to the meeting evaluation? I do have one quick announcement. Don't forget your PDC filings due April 15th if you want to get a jump on it. So other than that, let's move into the meeting evaluation. I see up in the upper left-hand corner of my screen is Matt.
Great meeting. Well run. Great information. I appreciate everyone's hard work.
Thank you. And Case?
Yeah, I believe we got an awful lot done today, approved lots of things that shows the previous work that we've done. And once again, appreciate all of the effort that the staff puts in preparing for these meetings. It's remarkable what they can accomplish with under the situations that they're operating under, which are just unbelievable.
Bruce.
Yeah, I mean, again, that great reports across the board, started with the, you know, the annual cancer report by Corey and Brandy's report, and I like Tyler's report. Well, we finished the year despite all the issues we had around COVID and the extra expenses and stuff. The way that we ended the year was great. So everybody's doing a great job.
Thank you. Maury?
Likewise, from what the three gentlemen said, great, very informative, very well run meeting. And yeah, I mean, we can't thank the staff, both the administrative staff who helped put the meeting together and make it in some ways exciting and fulfilling because of the good work that's being done, but also for the rest of the staff who day to day, day in, day out, come to work and take care of our community members. So I just, support everything three gentlemen said. Perfect.
And that makes a fifth from me. I support everything everybody has said. And I can't fathom how much hard work has gone into everything that our staff has done and how difficult this must be over all these months. It just keeps going and going. And I can't, it sounds like a broken record because everybody says, thank you so much, but it's heartfelt and, you know, I don't know how you can convey that other than thank you to everyone.
I've mentioned before that I saw something posting on Facebook. One of our nurses, who I've known for years because she's actually taken care of me when I've been in ICU, they are so, so, so tired of the situation, so tired and so much want to do the best job they can. And so I think they all need to know, certainly from me personally, that what a great job they're doing. And surely we appreciate them extremely much. I just can't say enough about all of our staff, how they're coming in every day and doing their work.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. Okay, if there's nothing further, then let's have a motion to conclude.
I move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion? Mike, thank you for everything. And you're included in that. You're at the top of the list there, too. So thank you for a great meeting.
Thank you.
And all in favor of concluding this meeting, raise your hand, please.
All right.
Thank you, everybody. Over and out.
Hasta la vista.
Stay safe.
Thanks.
Alyssa.